The Drum Candy Podcast is brought to you by Drum Factory Direct.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into episode one of season six of the Drum Candy Podcast. This is your host, Mike Dawson, coming to you from Drum Factory Direct in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We are thrilled to have David Throckmorton and Thomas Wendt back in the studio to kick off season six, and we're going to do 10 reasons to love the great Billy Higgins. Billy Higgins was an American jazz drummer born in 1936. He passed away in 2001. Most notably, he was a member of Ornette Coleman's adventurous free jazz ensemble, and then he went on to play on dozens of hard bop records. He was on many Blue Note sessions and many other sessions. Born in Los Angeles, moved with Ornette to New York, ended up back in Los Angeles where he taught at UCLA. He also established the World Stage Organization, which promoted jazz to the youth in Los Angeles. This was a really fun episode. I was not super familiar with a lot of Billy Higgins' discography, the records I know, I love. I know he's very consistent, so it was a lot of fun to let Throck and Tom throw out their favorite records, and we just dig into just the awesome sounds of Billy Higgins. So let's get to it. 10 reasons to love Billy Higgins.
Well, let's get started. How do we begin with Billy Higgins?
With our man Higgins. He is our man.
Why? It's a question for both of you. Why do we like Billy Higgins drumming so much? What is it?
He makes the music happen. I think his playing, I think he does that kind of naturally. Mm. His line was always that the drummer has to be kind. Yeah, and I think he plays like that. It's a very cliche thing. Everybody's like, oh, man, it's all about the groove. It's all about the music. Well, he actually lived that. So I think that's why, personally.
And he was in the house band for Blue Note for a long time, right?
He was on a lot of those dates in the early 60s, yeah. Mid, late 60s, all through the 60s, really.
What about you, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Tom says. He just makes the band sound great, makes the music come to life. I'm saying the same exact stuff, you know. I mean, I got more serious about listening to him with a lot of intent a little later in my life. Like, I mean, I'd heard him some when I was young, but became more of a uber fan a little later, you know. But I think maybe it was like a little less obvious in a way. Well, I mean, the playing is very sound and great, but like maybe it didn't have the overwhelming effect of like a Elvin or a Tony or even a Blakey in some way, beats being so so like aggressive or so powerful all the time. There's kind of a prettiness to his playing too that I kind of like, and I maybe as I'm starting to mature, I'm starting to appreciate that more and more. You know, but it's the he feels so good. You know?
Has he made a bad record? I mean, has he ever sounded bad, even when he was really ill? I mean,
not to my knowledge.
I can't think. I mean, there's some records I like better than others, but I can't think of a record where I'm like, I wish Billy wasn't on this. You know, wish it was somebody else.
He plays beautifully.
I remember I liked his playing very early on, but to Dave's point, I remember, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the first record I heard that I had that he was on that I really liked was Dexter Gordon's Go.
Me too.
Which is on Blue Note from 60,
Columbia House.
From 62. There you go, yeah. And I remember just loving the music and listening and loving his playing, but realizing that, you know, he didn't play anything like Art Blakey or Max Roach or even Philly Joe Jones, really, because his personality is just different, I think, personally and musically. Mm.
But like, strangely, like, those are the guys that are huge influences on him too.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
But he was also, I mean, Kenny Clark.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was
Shadow Wilson.
I just heard this interview yesterday. I was telling Tom, I found this interview with Billy that I hadn't heard before. And he was talking, yeah, he talked about Kluke, but he talked about Max.
Sure.
And Art.
Sure.
And Philly, you know, who else I'm forgetting? Roy Haynes, you talked about.
Yeah, I think in that generation, I wasn't around back then, but I've talked to a lot of people who were, and I think the music, the culture around the music was very, very different back then. And I think that, you know, there were, I just think the whole way that a person came to the music, became involved in it, and became successful back then is so different than it is now. I think in some ways it's very unfair to even compare it to today. Yeah. But yeah, he was certainly influenced by all those greats.
And his time field to me I feel like I relate to it in a certain way because it's so smooth and relaxed and chill, which I don't know where that's coming from. Maybe it's because he's from California and it's just a little more chill vibe. I don't know.
I hear it differently. I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree, but I hear an incredible intensity when he plays sometimes. Mm. But it's different than the way I think a lot of people would maybe think of a drummer playing intensely. I'm not you. Yeah. I'm not saying you in particular, but I don't know. His... You know, having the privilege to see him live a couple times was, I mean, I've talked to Dave a lot about it. It's one of the greatest experiences of my life. And it certainly influenced me a lot as just a musician, as well as being a drummer. But just, it's the effect he has on the music that's so magical to
me. You always use the word with, to me, not to steal your story.
No.
But you would always say the way he lifted totally. The music up. I mean, I totally get what you're saying, and I agree with you, and I also agree with Tom. I hear a smoothness and a...
I'm thinking like his swing feel is smooth. Not the volume is low.
Absolutely.
It can be really wide to me, too. There's a big width to his beat.
Well, that's the magic of it is, and the one track I picked, I will hopefully kind of illustrate that, but yeah, he has one of the most unique... cymbal beats. All the greats have unique ones, but his is especially unique.
What track is that? Let's go right to it.
This is Thelonious Monk live at the Blackhawk in California. This is the longer version of Epistrophe. And what we're going to hear is basically just the melody. So the way that Monk had a lot of different ways of playing this tune, but a lot of times the A section would have a funky sort of feel. Sometimes it would be a lot of times drummers would superimpose like an Afro-Cuban 6/8 over it, but that bo-bo-dee, you know. Mm. And so the way Billy Higgins plays it is he kind of plays it almost like what a lot of drummers would call a boogaloo. Mm-hmm. But then he swings the bridge. But listen, focus on his cymbal beat as he moves into the bridge and then back out, and then we'll talk about it.
All right.
So it's to me, it's very, very interesting to hear him make those feel changes, because on one hand, it's a definite feel change from more of like a boogalooistic, almost backbeat feel to swing. But the cymbal changes very, very little. Mm. He's playing a slightly different rhythm. On the A's, he's playing that da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-da. And then he's playing more of a traditional jazz ride cymbal pattern on the bridge. But it really shows how... To my ear, and I'm interested to hear what you guys think, his overall pulse doesn't change a whole lot. And that's not a bad thing. Mm. I think it makes that so unique and special, because Frankie Dunlop and Ben Reilly, who were probably the two drummers who played most in Monk's group, don't play like that. You know? They're both equally great, but they're very different conceptually, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I chose that because I was listening. I was like, wow, just to hear that subtle shift in the cymbal is so unique, you know? And nobody can play a boogaloo or swing quite like him as far as how
it
feels.
Cracks, always.
Totally. Oh, yeah. Very much so. And Throck, you said you're talking about the width of it. And that's the magic of the da-ga-da, 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 you know?
Yeah. Sometimes it almost feels like, as the years went by, sometimes it even feels wider.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of players, that can happen to a lot of players as they get older. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not to get, like, I was listening to a newer Joe Chambers record. We did the Joe Chambers one a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And even hearing him now, it's like all the ideas are still there. It just feels like there's more space.
Interesting. Wonder why.
I think you're just probably hearing hearing like they don't want to play as much as my guess.
You know? I think that happens to a lot of musicians is the fat goes away.
Yeah.
And you get that beautiful fillet steak of only what really matters. You know?
Well, since we're talking about his kind of in the cracks, swing straight feel and the way he approaches Latin music, for me, the first time I heard him was on Love for Sale off of that Dexter Gordon record. And the way he plays that, like, quote unquote, Latin beat in the beginning.
I know.
It was such a mystery to me. Like, it's not triplets. It's not ace. It's not sixteenths. It's somewhere in between.
It's magic. It's truly what it is.
And then the fact that he swaps the brush over to the other hand for the B section and keeps the stick in the other. I mean, it's cool. So let's go there next.
Feels so great.
So cool. And I'm just hearing like the way he adds tiny little bass drum accents in the melody. Like, come on, man.
Well, you know, that feel, because he's basically playing a fast bossa nova with as most of us would play with a stick and a brush. But what's interesting, especially in this, I mean, this is 1962, 63, so the bossa nova craze was brand new in this country. Mm-hmm. So that music was brand new here. And a lot of jazz drummers, they kind of half swing, you know, like if you listen to Art Blakey, Pensativa from Free For All, and he's playing the
cut,
which is actually a thing, you know? I mean, that actually became almost like a sub-style.
Yeah, well, that one we just heard was swinging like
crazy. It was great, yeah. And it, like, I even think if you listen to, it was a Ray Charles record from the early 60s on ABC. I think it's one of the Ray Charles sings country and western. It's not that. It's one of the others where it says featuring the new swing over rhythm. Mm. So they actually kind of made something out of that.
Swing over.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a huge thing, but back then it was a little bit of a thing, you know. So it's very interesting because, you know, if you were talking about, you know, Brazilian music, a lot of people say, well, that's not really correct, you know, but that's not what this is about, right? Yeah. It's and I'm glad you chose this. One of the other tracks that I chose is of him playing sort of a calypso thing, because he, like a lot of these masters, he had such a beautifully unique way of playing Afro-Caribbean rhythms, you know. I think all of the greats in this music sort of had their own take on how to do that, and I think it's a huge part. Like, if you think about Art Blakey, the way he did that, I mean, nobody plays that like that. Max, you know. So I think it's a big part of this legacy in the music. It's how those guys all played.
You're talking about St. Thomas, so we'll go there next. That's
sure
the tune?
Yeah,
before we do that, how would you play that brush thing? Would you kind of swipe it? I mean,
at that tempo, I think you could play the eighth notes, but you could use a side to side motion. That would probably sound great.
I've tried to play that record my whole life. It just ain't happening.
Well, man, part of it is like what you said about how it's, and this is what makes it so great is the intangible. Like, you can't write that down. Mm. You know, you can't write down accurately how he's phrasing that and how he's articulating.
It would look so weird. And then even, like, I'm thinking, like, transcribing where he hits those bass drum pushes. It would be...
It's very hard.
Why bother? Because right. then you're reading just some strange phrasing that doesn't make any sense.
Well, this is part of the magic of this music, is that so much of it, you just take it in and it's great. You can't, you know, you can't write it down.
Let's hop over to St. Thomas. So I hadn't heard this one before, and I know of the Sonny Rollins version. I assume this came out after that?
Oh, yeah. This is actually from 1992, I believe. This is a great record on Crisscross. And in the 70s, Cedar Walton's main trio was Cedar Walton, the great Sam Jones, and Billy Higgins. And when the great Sam Jones died, I believe he died in 1981, he recommended David Williams to take his place. And so from that point forward, Cedar's main trio was David Williams and Billy Higgins. And this is a great, it's the name of the record is Manhattan Afternoon. It's a great recording of this band. And this is St. Thomas. And they play it pretty fast, a lot faster than the original. But what I liked about it was the groove that Billy Higgins plays on it, because it's sort of his take on a calypso, a faster calypso. So we can listen to it and then talk about
it. It's another one. I don't know what the sticking is. You're going to help me.
I don't know what the sticking is.
Get the beginning, it's a one, a two, a one, but what the hell's he doing there? What is going on?
He had all kind of uniquenesses where he would combine, you know, a rim shot with the left hand and muted tones and open tones with the right hand. I mean, I don't know I'm not sure what the sticking is. I know approximately kind of what the groove is, but it's that magical Higgins magic, you know. And he had a lot of Afro-Caribbean grooves that were similar to this, where he might not play with a bell pattern of any kind, but he'll play between the drums. And if I did that, it would sound like a mess. It would be like, God, quit doing that. It's too, you know, but he had this way of playing like that, and it's just adding to the music. You know, it's really something.
It makes me think of Papa Joe for some reason.
Totally.
I don't know if that's where it's coming from.
Well, but he was influenced by Papa Joe and a lot of those swing era drummers, because he came up during that time when those guys were playing in the 40s, you know, so he was still hearing, you know, a lot of those guys. I think that's actually, in my opinion, people like Papa Joe Jones and Shadow Wilson, a few other drummers who had those big, wide cymbal beats. If you listen to records with Shadow or Papa Joe from the early mid-50s when the fidelity is better and they're playing on a big open cymbal, their beats are huge. I mean, even at fast tempos, it's just like, how do you do that? And I think he was influenced by a lot of that. You know,
makes sense.
I mean, that's just my opinion on that. You know,
Throck, we got to go to one of yours. Take your pick. I do Our Man Higgins?
Yeah.
Why not? Totally different energy.
Oh, man. We'll be right back.
could listen to all 9 minutes of that one.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorites.
You know, it's like, I think about, you know, his beat, obviously, a lot. You know, like I was saying earlier, the way that his cymbal beat feels. And on certain records, you know, it can feel a little different depending on who he's playing with, what the music, you know, what the, who the group is, what the style is, or whatever. But his comping thing is so unique, you know? And, like, even, like, on a record, like that record versus a record he made in the 90s or something, like, it's always still there. It's like he has this kind of, like, the, that's why I wanted to hear a little bit of him playing behind the solo. It's like, as soon as it starts, he just, well, it just has so much life to it, and he's so beautiful with those little buzzes and drags, you know what I mean? The way he, they're so crisp and
totally,
they feel so good, man, and they've worked so nicely against the cymbal beat, man. It's really, and it's a very different way of playing, and I think a lot of the drummers I listened to earlier in my life, like you know, it was a different way of playing comping, you know. Maybe a little more like, I mean, I don't want to say it's not basic, but it's maybe a little more repetitive in some ways, but it's not, he's not always playing the same thing by any means, you know. Like, he'll repeat a lot of things, like, there's always that, like, plays the heck out of that all the time, but it sounds so damn good.
Well, that's an interesting point, because that's something that many drummers in that era played, but they each sound very different playing it. Art Taylor sounds different, Max. I mean, they all play that bap, but they get it. It's slightly different, you know? And I think a lot of what you're talking about is, as far as the comping goes, and I when I saw him live, I witnessed this, and I think this is part of what makes him so kind of difficult to talk about sometimes, is that his whole, we talked about this last night when we were hanging, his energy as a human being is a huge part of this, you know? And that's one of the biggest things that I think I learned from listening to him and seeing him live, was your personality is very important, you know? And coming to the bandstand with a good attitude, one that is about making, you know, being about the group effort and make, you know what I mean? He exudes that. I mean, and that's something, seeing him live, it's just like, it like envelops you almost. It's a wonderful thing, man.
Yeah, I can imagine has to be one of the easiest drummers to play with ever.
It sounds like it.
It's just coasting. Like you said, it sounds friendly.
Totally.
And loving. It sounds warm and...
Well, we were talking about that a little last night. You know, one of the great Pittsburgh bassists, Dwayne Dolphin, played in Hank Jones's trio with Billy Higgins for a while. And Dwayne told me that the first time they played together, Billy Higgins came up to him and said, "How would you like me to play behind your bass solos?" You know, I mean, just, you know, and that, you know, that's a lot of who he is. You know, I think I try to keep a lot of that in mind, especially when I'm on gigs that might be a bit difficult or something is not, you know, happening and you're frustrated. You know, I think about that, like, okay, how would someone like Billy Higgins deal with this, you know?
And his beat kind of allows for things to move more, too.
Totally.
It's not tight. It's not airtight, so it kind of can... It never feels like it's speeding up or slowing down, but it's always kind of...
Yes.
Wherever we want to go, we can go with it.
Peter Washington, the bass player, told me that when he played with him, the thing that he loved is that Billy Higgins was great about waiting for someone to finish a phrase. He was great at accompanying or playing with people like that. He had such great ears, and he was so kind. Like, he was playing with you, and he was listening to how you phrase, and he wasn't trying to push you this way or that way. You know, it's all those little tidbits are very interesting. You know,
there's a lot of magic in there. Like, I was
totally,
as you were talking about, I was thinking, like, kind of contradiction. He sounds like he's barely hitting the drums. Like, his phrasing is pretty, like, I'm just letting the sticks do what they do, but it's so intense. It's like there's so much energy, but it's effortless. Like, that's the magic to me. Like, if I did that, I would just sound kind of like anemic and wimpy.
Right.
You're like, hit the freaking drums.
Yeah. Well, thanks to YouTube, there's all these cool videos that we can watch of him. And I think you can get a lot by just kind of watching how he does it. I think there's some answers in that to his playing. Not all answers, but I think because you see that, you can see his joy. You can see his, he has a very almost carefree feeling. But when he does stuff, there is totally intentional. He means every note that he's playing, you know.
What's that video where he's like sweating freaking bullets with a sweater on and a hat, I think? I can't remember. It's a concert, live concert, maybe in Europe or something. Okay. In Italy.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, it's like he's got water pouring out of him the whole time.
Yeah, man.
But he's playing like light.
A lot of intensity there, man.
All right, I'm gonna go to, this might be my all-time favorite record, Ornette Coleman, What Reason Could I Give? Right into it.
Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instrument, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair, and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street in Nashville, Tennessee, or call 615-383-8343, or go online at forksdrumcloset.com. Mm.
No, I'm pretty sure there's two drums on there, Ed Blackwell and Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell who's doing what. I don't care because they don't get in each other's way. I mean, I can tell by the tom sound what's Ed Blackwell, but otherwise I'm like, what is happening? And how do you come up to this? How do we arrive at this?
Well, I mean, you know, he has a, this is from Ornette Coleman science fiction from 71, I think 72.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And I think a lot of folks know that he has a history with Ornette being in his earlier groups because they were both based in LA. I think there are a lot fewer people that realize he made another record with him, this one in the early 70s. But he's known as being a very sort of straight ahead drummer. And he was, but he played not only with Ornette, he played with Ornette Coleman, Sun Ra, which is some very interesting records. And he played with a lot of very experimental musicians. And he was totally open to all of that, which that's one of the things I love most about him, is that, you know, he'll swing you into bad health. But then if you want to take a left turn and go to the cosmos, he's like, let's go. My bags are bad.
I mean, I think that's a big reason why those Ornette records are so liked, is because he's still making it feel right, even though you might not know where the music's going to go.
Yeah. I think he was a reason that, I mean, when, you know, Shape of Jazz to Come came out, I mean, that divided a lot of jazz fans. But I think because of the way he plays on there, that created a lifeline for a lot of people who wouldn't have even given that music a chance.
Mm-hmm.
That's conjecture on my part.
And he was playing with Ornette out west way before a lot of these associations he had with people on the East Coast that are playing more straight ahead jazz, you know?
I love hearing the later. There's some bootlegs from the late 80s with him playing with Ornette, which are really great. And they're so much fun to listen to, you know, because they're both just older.
Is
you
it
know?
Duets?
No, there were a couple reunion gigs with Don Cherry.
I haven't heard that stuff.
If you search around on YouTube, there's a few, and they're very interesting to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, that music in general is some of my favorite music ever, you know, like...
The early stuff or all of it?
Kind of all. I mean, yeah. Any of the stuff would... I mean, even other periods of Ornette's, you know, like 80, 81 with Matheny and Dejanet, like that's some of my favorite stuff. And the stuff with Elvin and Jimmy Garrison is great.
New York is now.
You know, Dewey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, New York.
The stuff with Ed Blackwell, the stuff with...
Love Call.
With Higgins, obviously. I mean, but like, it's weird. I didn't pick any of that for my
I didn't
three
either.
Picks. But it's almost probably because I don't think about the drums at all with Ornette's music. Like, in my head, it's just like...
The music.
This thing that happens. Like, this magical thing.
Totally.
But the drumming is amazing, you know?
The thing that I think, one of the things I love most about Billy Higgins, and we've talked about this, Throck, before, is that he kind of is just himself in every situation he's in, and it always works.
Yeah, so I mean, he's never made a bad record.
Well, the example I always cite is Pat Metheny in 83 made a record with Billy Higgins and Charlie Hayden called Rejoicing.
One of my picks is from that.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, we'll go there next.
So...
Yeah.
I remember, because I love that record too, but they're, speaking of YouTube, there's a bunch of videos from them touring, supporting that record. Mm. And they're playing a lot of that music, of course, but they're also playing a lot of Pat's tunes, like James, and there's, it's amazing to hear Billy Higgins play that music, because he's just doing his thing, and it sounds incredible. It works well. It's like, how do you do that, you know? I mean, can you imagine stepping into that gig and playing Pat's music? Like, and you know what I mean? Like, you're going to be thinking of all these, you know, the way it was played by all these other people. And there he is just doing his thing. And it's it's beautiful.
I think you can't, on some level, you can't help but be yourself. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I get what you're saying. It is unique to him in a way. But like, and this is not to take away from Higgins or anybody, but like, I've never heard Art Blakey not sound like Art Blakey.
Yeah.
I've never heard Elvin not sound like Elvin. You know what I mean?
No. That's true.
And I'm not saying that's exactly what you're saying, but
those are the.
Yeah, we're talking about the.
We're talking about the creators, masters, you know.
Yeah. So,
but like, you know, I'm saying like if I was in that position, I think it would be very hard to play Pat's originals,
yeah, which are so different.
Yeah. And to not think of Paul Wertico or you know what I mean. Because those guys are a big part of that music.
Yeah, we've heard so much of it.
Sure.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday with Wayne Krantz's band. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, because Tom's not coming from that like I am, you know what I mean? But I was like, you know, to hear that band, if I would have came into that band after Zach Danziger, we're getting way off topic.
No.
I would have been playing it kind of like Zach Danziger played it.
Mm-hmm.
But once Keith Carlock played the gig, you can never go back to playing it like
that's
that.
Interesting.
Because you're thinking about, oh man, this band has
that's what I'm talking about.
Evolved. Yeah. So Higgins is kind of coming at it like, here's my Billy Higgins stuff.
This is what I do.
Yeah.
And I remember watching those videos and just loving that, thinking like, that is like the epitome of like artistic greatness.
Yeah.
He's himself and it works.
Oh man,
you know?
Should all be so lucky. Billy Higgins is the Steve Buscemi of jazz.
Yeah, totally.
But it's a beautiful thing, man. I mean, it just shows. It shows. I think, as just a, not a drummer, but just as a what a great musician he was.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't remember any of the quotes directly, but I heard this interview yesterday that I hadn't heard, and everything he said, like you said about the human, how he is as a man, as a person, everything he was saying, is stuff you would expect to hear him say.
Mm.
It all reflects what we're hearing in the music, you know you gotta play where the music takes you. You have to listen. You have to, you know, if somebody wants to play a little more loose, you play a little more loose with them, you know. He's like, Dexter plays behind the beat, I'll just be a little more patient when I play with him versus somebody else that might play on top of the beat.
Absolutely.
And it's like, it's all about the ears and the spirit, like he kept talking about.
Well, I think you're 100% right, and I think that goes to an even more important thing, which is, it's just more about being a good person, is that's integrity, you know? I mean, yeah. How many times have you seen someone on a podcast and they're like, yeah, man, you know, it's all about playing for the band. It's all about the groove. And then you see them play and you're like, how's that?
Yeah.
Like, really? How's that work? You know? But someone like that, that makes perfect sense. You know, he has a lot of personal and artistic integrity. So, yeah, he's not going to.
Somebody's got some secret bus tapes of Billy Higgins just ripping somebody apart.
I doubt it.
Well, it's funny. Yesterday, I was telling Throck, a good friend of mine shared a great recording of Billy Higgins talking with Peter Washington in 1990. And Peter is asking him, he's asking him about playing with drummers when they play brushes. And he was saying how some drummers, it's really hard. And why is that, you know? And Billy Higgins is just he's like, well, you know, it's a different thing when you play brushes. You know, it's the same feeling, but it, you know, you're achieving it differently. And you have to, I mean, he's just given the most beautiful, sensible, like, you know, it's great, man. It's really wonderful, you know, to hear those guys.
I think a lot of, like, from meeting older drummers over the year and talking to some heroes that are older in general, sometimes you expect they're going to have all this real detailed drummy stuff to say, and they kind of never do. They're just saying life lesson, kind of simple, practical, kind things. And you're like, okay, that's all I'm going to get. I better just listen to the music if I want to figure out what the heck they're doing.
There's a huge lesson in that.
That's a huge lesson, and one that I'm dumbfounded when I work with students that just don't listen to music.
Oh, it's the.
I'm like, I do not understand.
Let me tell you.
Yeah, don't get me started, man.
Yeah.
Like, what are you trying to? It's just, I don't get it. I mean, I sort of get it. It's an activity, but when you're like, I want to sound like Billy Higgins, well, are you playing to the records? I mean, what more do we need to talk about? You know?
No, it's all in the records.
Well, let's go to Tears Inside, Pat Metheny.
Oh, yeah.
Is this from the top? Yeah.
Yeah. Start that over a little louder.
Sorry, I had the volume way down. I already love it.
Back to the comping, it's the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So crispy and snary too, and like the cymbal so bright, you know. Yeah. But that the difference between the short and the long notes with letting the stick kind of bounce forever, and then when he plays a single stroke, it just has so much
presence,
like new meaning after hearing these long strokes. It's like, whoa, listen to that snap on that, you know.
I don't know this record, and I'm gonna play from the beginning again. My first thought was Roy Haynes without the snarl. Mm-hmm. Like, it has that
yeah, it has some of that Roy thing.
That's a hip two feel.
He was.
And you know, that's coming out of, I'm sure Pat loves everything Higgins has ever done. But like, he got Charlie and Billy from Ornette's band, and they play a bunch of Ornette music. Mm. You know, it's like, then he went on to play 8081 with Ornette and Charlie. It's like, it's such a nod to loving that music so much, you know?
And it's a great sort of, you see the legacy continue and evolve, you know, which is really cool.
I got to hang with Pat once with my buddy Dan Wilson, and Pat was like the nicest guy ever. And I was telling him how much I liked this record, and he was like, "Man, that record is just such a disappointment for me. He's like, "I just don't think we're capturing what we got to on some of the gigs." And I'm like, "Dude, you're crazy. It's incredible.
Isn't that amazing?
It's so great."
Yeah. That's amazing.
I guess this was probably made before they toured or something.
I would guess. I think so, yeah.
I mean, come on. That sounds so good. I don't know.
And
this
the record covers a lot of different ground, and it's not crazy long. I really like the pacing of it.
I love that record.
Yeah, I really like it. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's an ECM record, so it's recorded very well. Mm. And, you know, it sounds great. Isn't that funny how he thought that? Mm. And we listened to it and we're like, "Man, I'm so glad that exists." Yeah, you know? And his view is like, "Eh."
Yeah,
it's so amazing.
Mathini, I mean, I'm sure he's proud of it and everything.
I hope he is.
But he was just
like,
"Man, I know we played better."
Yeah,
I'm like, dude, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, right. You got it.
Yeah,
I love the Mathini Trio. That's another band that I often sleep on. All the different versions of the trio. I do.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah,
I need to check that stuff out more.
All right, Tom, let's go with another one of yours. What do we got? We did Epistrophe. So we got another Lee Morgan tune, Hank Mobley.
Choose whichever one you're thinking of.
Well, let's go with the Lee Morgan.
Okay, which one is? Oh, this is
Pilgrim's Funny Farm.
So this is a.
I gotta cue it up. Hang on.
This is a really special record for me. This comes from a Lee Morgan Blue Note record called The Raja, which didn't get a ton of attention for a while, but it was recently reissued as part of the Blue Note Tone Poet vinyl series. And anyway, it's. The whole record is great. This is a really unique tune by a guy named Cal Massey, who is a trumpet player who was originally from Pittsburgh, but he grew up in Philly. It's a very unique tune. This is a clip from Hank Mobley's tenor solo. And what I love about this is his comping and the way he's interacting with Cedar Walton. This is Paul Chambers is on bass, Lee Morgan, Hank Mobley, Billy Higgins, and Cedar Walton. So we can listen to it and then talk about it.
So I have it queued up at 4:09.
I think that's correct, yeah. Love this record so much, man. So what I like about this is we've talked about his comping and about, I mean, he put, most of it is pretty simple technically, but it's the way he does it. But he's especially active on this. And there's a lot of movement and conversation between the bass drum and the snare drum. He even uses the tom-toms a little in comping, but the way that he would interact with simultaneously both the soloist and the pianist. That's a musical relationship that a lot of people don't talk about a whole lot is the relationship between the pianist and or guitarist and the drummer behind the soloist. There's all these relationships that are like happening all the time. And he was such a master at tending to all of them in the most like soulfully swinging way, you know. And he and Cedar had such a wonderful musical connection. And this was early on in that. So it's sort of interesting to hear it. But I love how he comps. And he's also, he's switching up the cymbal beat a little bit, which is interesting and really cool in how he does it, you know. So that's all I really had to say about that one.
He is a pretty active comper.
Yeah.
You know, like
in general, some,
Yeah, which I enjoy kind of, I always look forward to that when I listen to him. You know, like, wow, man, I don't play anything like that. It's so cool.
Yeah.
He very rarely leaves this position, which is what I'm listening to a lot now. Like, when do drummers leave the mm-hmm. time position? Mm-hmm. He doesn't leave it much. Mm-mm. Occasionally, like the end of courses or something.
Yep. Yeah, he you know, and of course, all of the records, especially on Blue Note from this era, I mean, Rudy Van Gelder captured that music so perfectly. It's, you know, we're so lucky to be able to hear it because, you know, like that.
We have three more.
Cool.
So we've got Evidence.
Yeah, play that.
Steve Lacy.
Ooh. Oh, I'm so glad you played something from this record.
I got is it from the top? Mm-hmm. All right, let me go back here. I don't know this record either. I realize I don't know a ton of his discography.
This is a good one.
Love Don Cherry's trumpet playing. Yeah, I know a lot of people don't.
Oh, Don's killing
me. He's so killing. And again, like, you know, there's no chords happening there, but like, the comping is so active, and there's so much space for it to be active, you know?
Yep. Yeah, that's
I'm saying nothing new, but it's like, it's that same. It's like, that couldn't be anybody but
totally.
Higgins.
Yeah,
totally.
The snare drum stuff and that beat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, he's sort of. Especially on this record, there's a lot of them like this, but he's kind of like, he's like the little engine, you know, mm-hmm. that's sort of powering everything, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way. That kind of describes that Ornette record too, where him and Blackwell are just an engine.
Yeah.
Just a motor pulsating over while they do this crazy shit.
Yeah, they keep it moving. And again, man, it's like, you think about some of these other leaders, like, Steve Lacy having Don Cherry and Higgins, or Coltrane playing with Don Cherry and Ned Blackwell and Charlie, you know what I mean? Or, you know, that stuff was so influential to like all these iconic musicians. Mm. They liked that thing and wanted it to be part of their thing. Or Sonny Rollins, Don Cherry, and Higgins, you know?
Oh, I don't know that one.
Henry Grimes.
Henry Grimes, yeah. There's some great video of that band.
Over in Europe, yeah. They only recorded a little on RCA. For Sonny Rollins, but yeah, that's another great band.
But think about those, like, those are like iconic.
Oh, totally.
Guys are like, oh man, let me get some of that thing.
Yep. One thing I love about how he plays with Ornette and on this record is it's almost his playing, it almost creates like a palette for those guys to paint on.
Mm.
You know, because if he were, especially like if you think of like Shape of Jazz to Come. If he played like totally free on that music, first of all, would be totally different. And those tunes, the melodies would lose a lot of meaning, I think. It's like you got to hear that against the backdrop of that beautiful little engine.
Yeah, he's not jumping on all the melodic.
No, not
stuff.
At all.
He's kind of letting it go.
Yeah, he's creating this space for that music to happen on, if you want to think of it mm-hmm. like that. Which I love that. Like, I think a lot of times as a drummer, when you're playing in situations that are a bit more open, you've done a lot more of that than I have. But I love doing that because it's a challenge. But I find sometimes you have to fight the urge to do certain things. And I feel like Higgins is so great at that. Mm. Like he just, it's like, here you go. It's like, here you go. Go ahead. Do your thing. You know, I got you. You know?
Yeah.
It's just, it's such a uniquely beautiful way to play that music, mm. I think.
And so. I hear a through line, maybe not, but. To the Miles Second Quintet, where the melodies just kind of happen over top of the rhythm section. It's way different, but it's not like they're getting all the stops and everything. They're kind of letting things go, or mm-hmm. Wayne and Miles are not quite planned the same way.
I think it was all part of the climate back then. You know, that's one of the most interesting things when you think about the different classic eras of the music, is just what the climate was to be. You know what I mean? Like, what was it like to be on a scene back then when all of that was happening? Like, I've talked to Roger a lot about that because he toured with Miles' second quintet with Horace's group. Can you imagine hearing that group every night for a couple months? Like, just to be there would have been an amazing thing. And I think that that's always a mysterious thing that I daydream about, with whether it's the 20s, the 30s, any of these classic eras. It's like, man, what was it like to just live there and be there? You know, because that's a huge part of all the music. So I think what you're talking about is true. But it was just part of the musical artistic climate back then. I don't know.
I think in the history books, it's a little bit too, like, every 5 years it changed to this and that.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
It's not the case, yeah. And this was, you know, this is Black American music, man. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful things that can't be written down or described in the Western European way. And that's, for me, that's one of the greatest things about it. It's just uniquely beautiful, you know.
Tom, you got one more.
Okay.
A slice of the top.
Oh, man.
This one I have to queue up. So,
this is another record, like the Raja, is really beautiful and important to me. And I should mention, since we're here in Pittsburgh, that both the Raja and Slice of the Top were records that were introduced to me when I was in high school by our dear late friend George Hyde Sr. These were big records for him, and they became big records for me. And this is the title track from Hank Mobley's Slice of the Top. I believe this was recorded in 1966. And it features Higgins playing with not a big band, but a larger ensemble. And this is also, the reason I chose this is listening to him switch back and forth between his uniquely Higgins Afro-Cuban groove and the swinging bridge of it. It's just really beautiful to hear him make those transitions and to listen to how great each of these different grooves feel the way he plays them. So
before I play it, how many did he make a bunch of records with Crenshaw?
With Bob Crenshaw? Oh yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
They were a great what he worked so well with so many different bass players. Herbie Lewis, Ron Carter, Paul Chambers, Bob Crenshaw, Sam Jones. There's so many that he sounded great with.
All right, here we go. This is 50. I'm starting 53 seconds in.
Yeah.
Plays that ride, that groove a little bit different each time. It's downbeat, it's back, it's syncopated.
Yeah, the cymbal bell stuff sounded a little like bigger on that than normal.
You know, it sounds like he's playing harder, right?
Well, it's a bigger band.
Bigger band, yeah.
But it's just, it's a personal thing for me, but this record is just one of those just... It has such meaning for me, and the way he plays on it, and the, you know, those little fills, you know, it's just that spirit is just, that's what the music is, man. You know what I mean?
Amazing.
I couldn't not choose something from this record because it's just the whole thing is great. If you're not hip to any of these records, do yourself a favor and check them out. You know,
what goes back to the thing Mike was saying about, I'm not trying to crap on younger musicians, but like, you have to listen to this stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
It's so beautiful.
And once you find that, once you get the bug, it never leaves, man. You just, and there's so much darn music out there.
I know.
And I've been listening to this. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just going to say, I've been listening to this record for 25 years, and just now, it's like, it gives me the same joy as the first time I heard it, man. It's so wonderful.
Well, we're going to end with what I thought we would start with, which is probably the most cliche Billy Higgins tune. And I think we can probably blame high school marching bands and high school jazz bands for kind of ruining the song.
I've never heard a marching band play it.
You never heard a marching
band? I don't think I want
to
hear that.
I don't go out of my way to like seek out a bunch of marching bands, but I never played it.
It was a thing in high school jazz bands. But the Sidewinder, this is a record for me that, because I'd heard this song overdone and done poorly, I had a hard time coming back to it. And then recently I'm like, you know what? This groove ain't easy, first of all. Almost everyone plays it wrong. And it's killing. It's so, and it has that in between. I don't know if this is considered a boogaloo. What would, I mean,
it probably would be, but the way he plays it, you can't really define it, which is so great.
So we're going to end with the Sidewinder. This whole record is amazing. I could have picked some of the other tunes, but I feel like we had to just have this tune in this episode. So we're going to fade out with the Sidewinder.
Hope you enjoyed that hang with Tom and Dave, and there's a lot of music there to discover. If you haven't already, Billy Higgins is on over 700 recordings, so we've just obviously just scratched the surface on his amazing career, amazing drumming. We're going to get to our warehouse pick of the week before we send you off. Let's check out some DFD Classic Series drumheads. These are some new drumheads that we had designed. They use DuPont Mylar, so premium Mylar. They are 7.5 mil thick, so they're a thinner single-ply head. We have clear and we have coated versions, and these are designed to look very similar to the stock drum heads that you would have found on classic drums from Ludwig and so forth in the 1960s. We have all the standard sizes, I believe from 10-inch toms up to 22-inch bass drums. Price is pretty crazy, I think the 10-inch is like $739 for the drum head, and the 22 is like $20. So incredibly affordable. They have an almost identical collar, a thin collar to the old Ludwig head, so they will fit on old drums very well. They have a light coating. It's coated, but it's lightly coated, so it's somewhat translucent, which means it'll give you a warm sound, but still have some of the tone that you'd expect from an old thinner drum head. So this is one I had on a snare drum in the studio for several months. Got a lot of use. You can see it's still holding up pretty good. It stretched out a little bit, but I was really smacking this thing for a bunch of hours in the studio. So this just came off my snare drum. I also put the coated 12 and 14 on my kit, and then the clear version on the bottom. This has a 20-inch bass drum with the coated version on the batter side. So you're gonna hear these heads on a 1968 Ludwig kit. I've got the drums tuned up high, bebop style, so you can kind of hear how it sounds in that world. You can hear a nice vibrant, open, bright, but still a little bit warmer sound than a clear head. So let's just play some drums, check them out. These are the DFT Classic Series coated and single ply heads. The snare I have an Evans Power Center reverse dot. Just as a reference, you can hear these heads in context with what you would think of as a modern, kind of like contemporary drum head. That is it for episode one of season six of the Drum Candy Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you do like the show, please give us a 5-star rating, write a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or go to YouTube, make sure you subscribe there, write some comments, spread the episode, share it with some friends. Always appreciate you. You can always reach me at drumcandypodcast@gmail.com if you have any show requests or questions. You can also hit up the Drum Factory Direct Instagram page, which I monitor regularly. So until next week, have a good one. Go listen to some Billy Higgins, and we'll see you then.